accession number 11086, Reel 2.
Squadron Leader Bartley, Reel 2. So you were talking about meeting Brian Kingcombe at the beginning.
Yeah, when I landed at the beginning. And I said, there was a bomber overhead. I said, what do you do now? And Brian just said, put on a tin hat and strike a hostile attitude.
So you were saying, you were going to tell me about when you first went up in the Battle of Britain. What happened on that occasion?
What from Biggin, you mean?
When you first arrived.
Oh yeah, well from then on in, we did 5 sorties a day. We never stopped. We just went. You went to your dispersal hut a half an hour before dawn, and you just, when the tannoy said scramble, you scrambled. You went up and you fought all day long until the sun went down, whether it be 3, 4, 5 missions a day. You just fought and fought and fought. And at the end of the day, we used to get off the airfield because they used to bomb us at night. So we used to go down to the White Hart at Braestead and drink beer. And then the bombing got so bad after a while, we were not allowed to live. The officers' mess was bombed, so we moved into temporary accommodation, which is an old army mess. It was a sort of prefab. And then fighter command was so nervous, there were 3 squadrons on the airfield, that they said we couldn't live on the airfield at night. So we were billeted in country mansions 3 miles from the airfield. 74 went one way, and we went another way, and there was another squadron there, went another way. And we just lived off the airfield. So at the end of the day, we just fought all day. And then we used to go to our billets just off the airfield, because we were not allowed to literally to communicate with each other, because they were afraid that one bomb, if we were all in the officer's mess together or the sergeant's mess together, the one bomb would knock off a whole, all the pilots of 3 squadrons. So we used to meet up in the wing when we were airborne. We never saw each other otherwise. We were segregated.
Did you obey that order?
What?
Did you obey that order?
Oh yeah, we did. We just lived in our billet. And then we used to go to, we had our favourite 92 Fighter Squadron, had the White Hart at Braestead. And they've got all our signatures up there now to this day. The original blackout curtain is in the RAF Museum, or Battle of Britain Museum. And so, and they had their own local pub, because they lived east, we lived west, and somebody lived north. But we were not allowed to live on the airfield at that time, to, in case we were all written off by a bomb.
How did the public treat you during the Battle of Britain?
They loved us. And I mean love. They bought you drink. They appreciated everything. They'd forgotten the acrimony that there was temporarily, you know, about the army versus fighter command. After Dunkirk, they realized, after what Churchill said, he sort of cooled it, and it was explained. And from then on in, I mean, a fighter pilot was, I don't know, you were just, you were absolutely the epitome of affection and glamour and idolatry. Unbelievable.
Did you, in the Battle of Britain, feel that you were taking part in an historic occasion?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, we knew it. We knew that you know, we knew that if Fighter Command was defeated, you know, the operation, whatever it was called, you know, the landing that was being laid on, would go forward. But until everybody knew that air supremacy was the crux of the whole thing. If Great Britain lost air supremacy, in other words, if Fighter Command was defeated, then everybody, the barges would come over and come over to England, land, you know, the landing invasion forces would come, the German armada would arrive, and of course Hitler knew it, and Goering said, well, I'll defeat the Royal Air Force. And Hitler said, well, you better, because we can't move until you do. He said he would. And September the 15th, I was flying. I did five sorties on that day. It was a crunch when Goering just gave up. They said, we can't beat him. And so they gave up the huge onslaught on, you know, because their losses were so terrific. I may say ours were too. But then they called off the invasion. They decided, and then of course the weather came down, thank God. But it was a fantastic, I must say, day after day in September, we were rather longing towards the end for beginning of October for the cloud, because we were getting desperately tired. Oh, we never stopped. We never stopped.
Did you ever catch sight of the invasion barges?
No, I think the fellows, probably the Hurricanes, did. We were flying always high, because the great race was for the height. And, you know, the Spitfires, the Hurricanes and the other people, they saw them, of course. But I never saw the invasion barges.
When the German planes came over Britain, was there any sense on your part or those of your brother officers in the RAF of a sense of outrage that they should be flying over Britain?
No, that was part of the action. They were, their plan, we knew, was to first bomb the airfields, then of course then they couldn't, then of course they attacked London, you know, which we thought that was pretty grim, but still. Then we attacked them even worse. So we retaliated and we put 1,000 raid over, what was it, the first 1,000 bomber raid. I was out picking up, we were sort of looking for people that had fallen in the sea from that huge raid. What was that huge 1,000 bomber raid?
Over Cologne.
Cologne.
But coming back to the Battle of Britain, what was your attitude towards the enemy pilots? Did you hate them or respect
no,
them?
Not at all. No, not at all. No, I mean, they were the enemy, and you know, there wasn't any hate involved. I mean, the bombers, we went for the bombers to try and stop them reaching London. We just, we shot at the aeroplane, not at the people. That's the thing, you shot at the aeroplane. You didn't shoot at the pilots. Pilots, we were all pilots. Well, they were, of course, the bombers, they were navigators, they were all airmen anyhow. But we never had any antagonism, hatred against the enemy. I mean, you shot at the aeroplane, not at the man in it.
Which part of the aeroplane?
Depends from which angle you attacked it. You attacked it from any angle. Some people attacked them head on, some people attacked them from the rear, some people attacked them, you know, depends where you met them, from angles. And
what was your favorite method of attack?
I would say coming in on the quarter, you know, sort of dead astern was a tricky one, because they had all their guns firing backwards. But if you came in, some people, Kingham said that he used to come down and attack them head on. No, I used to come in from the quarter, you know. That was the best way.
And then whereabouts on the plane would you aim?
Well, you aim like you aim at a pheasant, a little bit in front, you know, so it flies into you. By the time you shot, you know, it flies into you. You aim at the little ahead, I would say, probably. And then as it goes through, catch you. Or from the top, of course, you come down from the top. Mostly the best thing to do is to get above and then come down out of the sun.
Did you ever see any of the opposition pilots close up, or did they signal to you?
Dunkirk, fighting the 110s in that story I told you about, the close circle, you could see them, particularly the rear gunners. You could see them because you're so close. Otherwise, you saw them shooting at you. Well, you shot at them too. But I don't think otherwise you ever saw.
Did you ever meet any captured German pilots?
No, I didn't.
What did you think of the tactics which the Germans adopted during the Battle of Britain? What did their formations look like, and what did you think?
Well, they just had a huge... they used to have formations of their twin-engine bombers, you know. About nine they used to have, I think, you know, and flying in threes. And then they had their escort fighters up above, waiting. The 110 seems to be out of action by that time, as far as I can remember. It was just the twin engine, you know, the Dorniers and the Heinkels, twin engine, with the thousands of fighters whippling, swiveling around, whistling around overhead, you know, smoke trails in the sky, and just protecting them, weaving, you know. And so the Spitfires used to go for the fighters, and then the fighters, the German fighters, and then they used to break up. And once we'd broken them up, then the Dougie Barley used to come down with a wing of Hurricanes from north of London. But we used to have to break them up, all the southern fields, you know, we broke up the fighters. And then the wings, you know, Douglas Barley's great thing about the great wing. We didn't have time to form a wing. You know, by the time we got the alert that they were coming over the Calais, Dover, you know, we had to scramble up to get as high as we could into the sun and break them up. And then, of course, the Duxford Wing, as we used to call it, which was another group. We were 11 group. This is 12 group Duxford, was it? I think. Anyhow, then they used to come in with their huge wings of fighters. They'd have six squadrons all together. Dougie Barter, so, soldiering on. Bless his heart.
Did you ever get to know Douglas Barter?
Very well. Very well.
What kind of a man was he?
He was great. He's a great lad. He's great. He was very bigoted, you know. He was... there was a big argument one time, which I was heavily involved in, about cannons versus machine guns. And old Douglas used to say, well, I got my eight machine guns. You get in close enough, it's good enough for anything. Who needs cannons? Well, which was wrong, actually. And eventually... right at the end of the Battle of Britain. Well, the Battle of Britain was over. We were down at Manston, and we were experimenting with the 20mm Hispano cannon. And we had four of them in the squadron, and I was flying one. And nobody knew. Barter said eight machine guns, and somebody said two cannons, four machine guns. And, you know, there was everybody was debating what armament to take. And I was down at Manston, and I happened to be flying a two-cannon Spitfire, two cannons for machine gun. And we were alerted. There was a lone bomber had been come over, cloud cover. They were using cloud cover. This was, you know, March of 1941. You know, the battle was over. But they used to send over lone predators, you know. They just bombed the airfield at Hornchurch, I think it was. And I was vectored onto this thing, and I told the controller at 11 Group that I was flying a cannon Spitfire. And I said that I'd seen the bomber. And they said, or I suggested, whatever it was, either they suggested or I suggested at 11 group, that I had the cannons and I leave my transmitter on and I would give them a blow-by-blow description exactly what effect the cannons had on this bomber, because I was going to shoot it down. So I left my transmitter on and I gave a running commentary, and absolutely came up behind it, and he was shooting at me, but I didn't try it. You know, I really wanted to see what they would do, and I came up behind him, and I got to the proper range, and I fired, I think, about 14 shells from one. The cannons were always jamming. That was one reason that, at that time, that people were against cannons. Douglas Bader was, anyhow. But anyhow, I fired about 20 shells from one and 12 from another, 20 millimeter Hispano, and the aeroplane just blew up. And I gave a whole description, and parachutes are flying out, and blood was flying all over the place, and he just went down and into the sea, and I gave a running commentary on it, and I used them. I said, I got the buggers blown to pieces. And when I got back, I was called by the group, the 11 group, and saying, I probably used in slightly worse words than that. And they said, well, thank you very much. You know, it was a brilliant description. But your language, he said, you remember, we have WAFs in the operation. So I said, I'm terribly sorry. And from then on, we converted to cannons.
Was that blood literally flying around?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did that happen?
Not very often. No, if you got... You know, you get close, and not very often, but that's the only time it ever happened to me, but it came over my windshield. But that's the only one time ever.
In the Battle of Britain, was it fought in what you might call a spirit of fair play?
Definitely. Definitely. The officially, if you were shot up badly and you parachuted, you're over your own territory, you could, I don't know what the laws, but you could officially shoot the airman, because if he escaped over his own territory, he'd get in another aeroplane and he'd be just as dangerous as he was before. So officially you could shoot an escaping pilot in a parachute if he's escaping his own territory. But I never saw it done, I never heard of it done, and that's on both the German side and the RAF side. If a pilot landed in the sea, particularly in the winter time, when it was bitterly cold and life expectation was about 20 minutes, I think, in the North Sea, because of the cold, you never shot at an airman in his May West any more than you shot at the escaping German parachutist in a parachute, or British parachute, unless he was escaping over his own country. But I've never seen that done. Anyhow, we didn't shoot at them. We didn't shoot that. Air sea rescue boats, we used to never shoot at. And they were completely and utterly at anybody's, you know, you could just knock them out, you know, air sea rescue boats. Now, we had a communication, I don't know how it came about, between, well, Adolf Gallant was a Saint-Omer, his wing, and we had one somewhere down in the south. And we communicated with each other. And if we had an airman they had an airman, whichever was the easiest to salvage, it didn't matter which nationality, whichever was the easiest to get him out before the 20 minutes, you know, they froze to death, we'd say, look, we've got one of yours down there, we've got one of yours, you know, one of ours here, and we got one of ours there, and you know, and we used to, the boats used to go out and pick up the airmen from the sea, and nobody'd shoot at the boats, and nobody'd shoot at the downed airmen. So there was a sort of camaraderie amongst fighter pilots. I'm talking about fighter pilots.
Was that because you felt, well, I might be in that sense?
I don't know, we just did it that way. You know, and I mean, when Dougie was shot down by, I don't know who shot him down, Adolf Gallant, I think it was, he came down and they finally only had one leg, of course they didn't believe it. And, you know, he went and Adolf, you know, said, give me your words, an officer and gentleman, but try to escape and spend the weekend, you know, at the officer's mess, you know, while we're trying to find your other leg. And so Dougie said, okay, and so he stayed in the mess, having given his thing that he wouldn't try to escape, which of course we were all pledged to do once we had taken prisoner. You had to escape, try to anyhow. Well, we just pledged to do it. And so as soon as they got his leg back and they put him in hospital, they shook hands and Dougie says, okay, I'm free, thanks very much. So now, within 48 hours, he escaped from the hospital. Of course, he was caught.
How do you think the strength of fighter command was affected by the fact that the people in it were by no means all from Britain, but from all over the world, really?
Well, I think that the strength of fighter command was very largely based on the nationalities of the pilots. I mean, when I say nationalities, predominantly, of course, from the British Commonwealth of Nations. In my squadron, we had, well, I talked to you about Roger Bushell, who's a South African. My flight commander, to begin with, he was an Irish South African, Paddy Green. Then we had Canadians, Australians, New Zealands, and who sometimes I felt when, you know, sometimes when someone lacked something, the other compensated for it because of the different part of the world, and I think that they came from, and you know, if one had a slight weakness in some area, then somebody from Australia or New Zealand or something compensated for it, and the whole conglomerate, the whole team together, the Commonwealth, mostly Commonwealth. I mean, we had Czechs and Poles who were very brave, you know, and we had a Frenchman in our squadron during the Battle of Britain. But together it made an absolutely indestructible team, because the morale, everybody's morale was compensated by the others, and the whole thing put together was undefeatable, because the spirit was, we never thought we could, nobody ever said, what happened if we lose the Battle of Britain? I mean, none of us ever thought, it never even crossed our minds that we would lose the Battle of Britain. It crossed our minds, of course, that we would be killed, because all our friends were getting killed, but we never crossed our minds that we wouldn't ultimately prevail and defeat the Luftwaffe. And we took it for granted, and we did, and it was as simple as that. And I believe that that mélange of different nationalities that made up the fighter pilots, I don't know, I always had a feeling it had it contributed a great deal to the overall fortitude and confidence.
Now, you come from Ireland, which was a neutral country,
yeah,
during the war. Did,
yeah,
that make any difference to your attitude towards the Battle of Britain?
No, not at all, because I talked about New Zealanders and South Africans and Australians and Canadians, but of course, although being an Irishman, some of the greatest fighter pilots in the Battle of Britain Of course, were Irish. And a good proportion of them were Irish. I mean, you talked about Paddy Finucane, just to mention one, you know.
So you felt just as strongly as English and Scottish?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, although my family, the Bartley family, came from... they were Northern Ireland, really, well, before Ireland was partitioned, so they came from Ireland. But my father, when he left university in Ireland, he was a barrister of law of Ireland, but he went out to India, you know, there was all the Irish and colonised the colonies. And he was a Supreme Court judge in Calcutta during the Battle of Britain. And I was brought up in England, and I thought of myself as English, really. I was educated. I was born in India and came back when I was 6 years old. Brought up and educated in England, went into the Royal Air Force, and thought of myself as, well, I knew I was Irish, but I thought of myself as English.
So you felt just as strongly that the Luftwaffe had to be defeated?
Yeah, well, I never met anybody in Ireland, I mean in England, none of my Irish friends were anything but absolutely, you know, just pro-British, whatever they regarded themselves, like Finucane and all the people, as British and fighting, you know, with like the Scots, fighting with the Brits, the English, and the Welsh. They were no different. Mm.
Do you remember any particular incidents in the Battle of Britain which you were involved in yourself, which you can relate in detail, which you can actually describe?
Yeah, I'll tell you one quite interesting thing that happened, you know, relative to what I was telling you about whether or not people shot at airmen escaping in their parachutes. I was shooting at a bomber over Kent, a German bomber, and I'd forgotten the crucial thing. Remember, look behind. You know, but I was so concentrating on this thing, and I just wounded him fatally. I mean, I hit the airplane, the bomber. I'd forgotten that, and the 109 came down, and he caught me, and really shot me very, very badly. I mean, my airplane, and because I'd forgotten the cardinal rule of to look behind, so I knew that my airplane was finished. So I quickly undid my straps. I had one leg over the side. I was going to use my parachute. And he came around at me again. And I thought, now if I bail out, if he doesn't play the rules that I think he should play, that we play, I'm a deader, because he'll shoot me in my parachute. So I thought, well, the only way to do it, so I had literally a leg out, but he didn't see, he didn't know how badly he'd hit me. So I got back in, I'd undone my straps. I got back in, and I did a tight turn. And the 109 always knew that the Spitfire could turn inside the Messerschmitt, the Spitfire could turn inside the 109. And so I got inside him, and although I could hardly see because the oil and, you know, my engine was going, I fired a burst, you know, I had tracer. And whether he thought that he didn't know he'd hit me as hard as he did, or but whatever it is, I got inside him, and I was attacking him then, and he took off. Mind you, he was, you know,